Tonight, we are going to be dealing with missionary pioneers who changed the world. These are examples of excellence, and I'm going to limit myself to just two of the many missionary pioneers we could focus on who changed the world. But these two really are examples of excellence that have so much to teach us, so many applications to our present challenges today. First of all, William Carey, the father of modern missions. Now, if you sometimes feel overwhelmed by the immensity of the task before you, or if you feel discouraged by the seemingly never-ending series of obstacles and opposition, of frustrations and failures, take heart. The man whom God used to launch the modern missionary movement, William Carey, he seemed to have everything against him. He was brought up in abject poverty. He never had the benefit of high school. He never went to high school. He had, however, a thirst for knowledge. He read widely, and he had a keen interest in nature. Carey's formal education ended in junior school, yet at age 12 he taught himself Latin. Then he went on to master on his own Greek, Hebrew, French and Dutch. He eventually became Professor of Bengali, Sanskrit, Maranathi at the prestigious Fort William College in Calcutta, where civil servants were trained. I wonder if he knew something about the principles of discipline that David was speaking about earlier today. Undereducated, underfunded, underestimated, Carey and his co-workers, William Ward and Joshua and Hannah Marshman, they started over 100 Christian schools for over 8,000 Indian children of all castes. And he launched the first Christian college in Asia, Serampore College, which continues today with about 2,500 students any given year. William Carey finally succeeded in translating the Bible, the complete Bible, into six languages, and New Testaments and Gospels into a further 29 languages, making him the most prolific Bible translator in the history of the world. Any of us would be delighted to translate the Bible into a language. Imagine someone who could translate the Bible or portions of it into 35 languages. It's mind-boggling. And he never went to high school. Carey's achievements are all the more astounding when you consider his bold project to plant the gospel amongst the Hindus in India was completely illegal. By an act of British Parliament, it was illegal for any missionary to work in India without the permission of British East India Company, who said they wouldn't allow missionaries there because they would undermine their business. For the first 20 years, Carey's mission to India had to be carried out with ingenuity and circumspection. In other words, covertly, illegally, under the radar. He had to be based under Danish protection in the small Danish colony of Serampore. But at last, the British Parliament, under pressure from evangelical members of Parliament such as William Wilberforce, reversed its policy and compelled the British East India Company to allow missionaries in India. But that was 20 years later. Carey was also subjected to vicious criticism and gossip. Anybody who wants to get involved in missions will find their people with a gift of criticism and a ministry of discouragement. Under the extreme heat and abject poverty, initially with daily dangers from snakes, crocodiles and tigers in a remote mosquito-ridden jungle house, William Carey's wife, Dorothy, went insane. And it's not hard to work out why. She would rant and rave, and on several occasions she attacked him with a knife. She was diagnosed insane and spent the last 12 years of her life in chains. The Careys also lost their 5-year-old son, Peter, who died of dysentery, 1794. Every family member suffered from malaria, dysentery, and a host of other tropical diseases frequently. Carey's first co-worker, John Thomas, squandered all their money and bankrupted the mission in the first year, forcing Carey to work on a plantation to provide for his malnourished family. In their first 7 months in India, the Careys had to move home 5 times, each to a poorer location. Although the Careys wrote home regularly to family and missionary society frequently. It was 17 months before they got their first letter back. It took 6 months to go by boat from Britain to India. So a letter, best case scenario, would take 12 months to answer. 6 months there, 6 months back. People here can get discouraged if they don't hear from somebody for 17 hours. But he was 17 months before he got his first letter. And that letter that he got was a letter of criticism from the mission society, criticizing him for being swallowed up in the pursuits of a merchant. Well, they weren't exactly supporting him. Somehow, while often sick, holding down a full-time job, surrounded by domestic turmoil, with an insane wife literally screaming from the next room, Carey mastered Bengali and Sanskrit. If you've got difficult scenario and situation for your studies, consider William Carey. It might cheer you up. But by 1797, less than 5 years after he arrived, the New Testament was translated into Bengali and ready for printing. Carey had also established several schools and was preaching regularly in Bengali. However, after 7 years of tireless toil in India, William Carey didn't have one single convert to justify all these sacrifices and all this pain. How did William Carey manage to maintain such a productive schedule while having to endure all these crushing disappointments, endless distractions, undeserved criticisms, physical ailments, and heartbreaking tragedies? How did he manage to persevere? How did he have the spiritual stamina to keep on keeping on without even the encouragement of one single convert to justify all this effort and sacrifice? How? To understand what motivated this remarkable man, we need to look back at what inspired him in the first place. One of the most influential sermons in world history was preached on the 31st of May, 1792, by William Carey. He preached at Northampton, England, in this house, which today is a museum. Carey's sermon literally sparked the greatest century of Christian advance. It marked the entry of the English-speaking world into missions. I actually got to this house. I was speaking at a conference in England, and I got so excited, I said, "We passed Northampton." The man said, "Is there something significant about Northampton?" I said, "Yes, that's where the world missionary movement was launched." And these people in England were looking a bit surprised. And there we went and we found the house. It was great. Since that time, English speakers have made up 80% of the Protestant missionary workforce for 200 years. That started with William Carey and this sermon. The text of this historic sermon was Isaiah 54, verses 2 to 3. "Enlarge the place of your tent. Let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen the cords. Strengthen your stakes. For you shall expand to the right and to the left. And your descendants will inherit the nations and make desolate cities inhabited." That was the text. And the theme of the sermon was summarized as, "Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. God is great. Honor Him with great faith and great endeavors." Yet, riveting as this sermon was, the result was initially indecision. Carey was considered an enthusiast. That's what they called fanatics back in the 1700s. "You, sir, are an enthusiast," they would say, disparagingly. He was considered an embarrassment because he had a bee in his bonnet about missions. But Carey persisted until 5 months later, 12 Reformed Baptist ministers formed a particular Calvinist Baptist society for the propagation of the gospel amongst the heathens. Not a snappy title that can be easily abbreviated, but nevertheless, this was the world's first denominational mission society. Their first collection from these pastors amounted to £13, 2 shillings, and sixpence, and with that they launched the modern missionary movement. What inspired Carey's landmark book, the most important book in the history of missions, An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens? In fact, it's a 42-name title, and that's the title page. Not exactly a well-designed cover, and yet, if this is ever an example of you cannot judge a book by its cover, this is it. The cover looks as boring as anything, and yet this book launched the modern missionary movement. And Operation World, the most successful missions book in history, says the inspiration, the first true mission survey of the world situation, the inspiration foundation for Operation World, was William Carey's An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians Whose Means to the Conversion of the Heathen. What inspired this sermon, this book, this mission society, this pioneer prototype mission society, was his eschatology of victory. Eschatology means study of the last things. William Carey was a post-millennialist who believed that Christ, who commanded his church to make disciples of all nations, would ensure that the Great Commission would ultimately be fulfilled. That doesn't sound too radical a position, but let's face it, most Christians today believe that everything's going to end in abject failure. Everything's going to fall to pieces, Antichrist's going to destroy everything, and the church will be rescued with the rapture, and basically the Lord will come in with a 7th cavalry rescue for a defeated church, and the whole operation is going to end in failure. And so this position is the most positive, optimistic, victorious vision of the end times. But it's predicated on this assumption that God, who gave the Great Commission, will enable his church to fulfill the Great Commission. That doesn't sound too radical, but some people could get hysterical if you articulate this. The work to which God has set his hands will infallibly prosper. We only want men and money to fill this country with the knowledge of Christ. We are neither working in uncertainty, nor are we afraid for the result. Christ must reign until Satan has not one inch of territory. Time and again, in the face of crushing defeats, disappointments, diseases, and disasters, William Carey reiterated his unwavering optimistic eschatology. Though the superstitions of the heathen were 1,000 times stronger than they are, and the example of the Europeans 1,000 times worse, though I were deserted by all and persecuted by all, yet my faith, fixed on that sure word, would rise above all obstructions and overcome every trial. God's cause will triumph. And Carey's faith was most certainly vindicated. The years of hard work and wholehearted sacrifice were graciously rewarded by God, and Carey's ministry literally transformed India. When Carey stepped ashore in Calcutta, 11th of November, 1793, India was in a terribly degraded state. If an infant was sick, it was assumed that he was under the influence of an evil spirit. The custom was to expose sick infants to the elements, hanging them up in a basket. Near Malda, Carey found the remains of a baby who had been offered as a sacrifice to be eaten by white ants. At the Sagar Mele, where the Ganges River flows into the ocean, Carey witnessed how mothers threw their babies into the sea to drown or to be devoured by crocodiles. This, the Hindus regarded as a holy sacrifice to the mother Ganges. Carey undertook a thorough research into the numbers, the nature, the reasons for this infanticide. He presented several petitions to the government until in 1802 infanticide was outlawed. This marked the first time that the British government interfered directly with the religious practices in India. It set a precedent for the abolition of other evil practices. Hinduism had an extremely low view of women. It was often stated in Hinduism, there's no salvation for women unless she is reincarnated as a man. Her only hope lay in serving men in complete subjection. That is the position in most pagan religions, actually. Many female babies were smothered or strangled or drowned at birth. Girls were married as young as 4 years old. Widows were perceived as a bad omen who had brought about the deaths of their husbands. Widows were seen as an economic liability. Bereaved widows had to shave off their hair, remove all jewelry, and were forbidden to remarry, but were required to cohabit with their deceased husband's nearest male relative. Here's an example, this picture of a widow mourning for 50 years. Tremendous pressure was exerted on the widow to submit to sati, or immolation, to be burned alive on the funeral pyre of her husband. Amongst the weaver or Kauri's caste, widows were buried alive. So because of the Hindu practice of sati, children who just lost their father would also lose their mother and be orphaned at the same time, and all their inheritance would go to the next male relative in the family. The children would be left destitute. This is a social catastrophe on the highest level you could imagine. The Hindu practice of polygamy compounded the problem. On one occasion, Carey documented 33 wives of one man being burned alive at his funeral. On another occasion, one 11-year-old widow was burned on the funeral pyre of her husband. This is what happens when you've got pedophilia and polygamy in a culture, along with widow burning. Lepers were rejected by their families and society and condemned to be burned alive. Hinduism taught only a violent, fiery end could purify the body and ensure transmutation into a healthy new existence. Euthanasia was also practiced, and those afflicted by other sicknesses would be basically left out to be eaten by crocodiles or drowned or to die of cold or heat or starvation by the river. The infirmed were regularly carried to be left out to the cold, heat, crocodiles and insects by the riverside. So William Carey, the missionary, fought against all these and many other evils, including prostitution, child prostitution, slavery, the caste system. He publicly criticized the government, meaning the British government, for inaction and passivity in the face of murder. He organized public debates and he spoke out and he wrote on these atrocities. And at first these met with official indifference. The Indian Supreme Court in 1805 ruled that sati had religious sanction and therefore could not even be questioned. There's other things that might surprise you about William Carey, this simple cobbler. He established the first newspaper ever printed in an Oriental or Eastern language, the first newspaper in Asia. The Sawakar Darpan, an English language newspaper, Friends of India, which continues to this day. William Carey pioneered mass communications in India. He launched the social reform movement because he believed above all forms of truth and faith, Christianity seeks free discussion. We're not afraid for debate on anything. Truth does not fear investigation, dissension, questioning, or debate. William Carey was the first man to stand up against the brutal murders and widespread oppression of women through female infanticide. Today it's done through sex selection abortions in India and in China. So there are something like 150 million less females than males in India and China today. And that's through abortion, sex selection, amniocentesis, discovering the sex of the baby in the womb and then deciding, oh, it's female, let's have an abortion rather, because they are devalued in that pagan society. Child marriage, polygamy, enforced female illiteracy. As was said by the Hindus, why would you need to teach a woman to read? You no more need to teach a woman to read than for a cow to read. Quote, unquote, from Hindu religious leaders. And then forced euthanasia, where women would be literally held down over the funeral pyre of a husband with these poles, which people are holding on bamboo poles on all sides, and they're all pushing down. So she's lying there screaming. They've got the drums playing and everything else and the music. So to drown out her screams while she's being burned alive on the funeral pyre of her husband. This happened hundreds of thousands of times in India. And by the way, I mention this because in 1999 we had in Cape Town the World Parliament of Religions. And there were people from all over, including the Dalai Lama, Living God, and some goddess from South Korea, and who knows what other nonsense was there. And there was a lot of World Council of Churches, apostates, all part of this. So we demonstrated, we designed tracks that we were evangelizing at the event, and we went and attended some of the events before they threw us out. But at one of the workshops run by a Hindu professor, he said, there's no such thing as right or wrong, and it is cultural imperialism and it's insensitivity and chauvinism for anybody to go to another culture and tell them that something in the culture is wrong. So when it gave time to questions, one of our missionaries said, was William Carey wrong to oppose widow burning in India? And there was this long silence. And the impact obviously hit him squarely between the eyes. And he stumbled and he muttered, talk about hesitation. he took an age. I don't know how long it was, but it was painful. And his final answer, you'd never guess. This Hindu professor from India, in answer to this question, was William Carey wrong to oppose widow burning in India? Was, well, widow burning didn't affect that many people. What kind of gutless, heartless comment is that? If just one was murdered in that way, it's too many. But hundreds of thousands not only died, but millions of their children were orphaned as a result of this over thousands of years. Before one brave Baptist missionary stood up and said, that is against the word of God. And he made a stand. And he made a nuisance of himself until the politicians couldn't ignore him. Carey conducted systematic research. He publicized his writings to raise public protest in both Bengal and in England. He educated and influenced a whole generation of civil servants through his lectures at Fort William College. Now, why would the British government ask a man who was engaged in illegal activities, who they hated, who didn't even have high school education, why would they have him lecturing their civil servants in Fort William College? Because nobody knew Sanskrit, Bengali, and all the Indian languages better than William Carey. So it didn't matter how much they hated him and what he stood for. He knew the languages. He had language acquisition more than anyone else. And so the British government had to turn to him. Nobody else knew the culture, the history, the languages of India better than him. So they had to turn to this hated and despised missionary. And at one of the British government official events at the Raj, where Professor Carey, who's now Dr. Carey, because he's a doctor of Oriental languages, not bad for someone who didn't do high school. At one of these events, some arrogant British woman said to him, Dr. Carey, I believe that you were a shoemaker in England. Obviously to put him down in front of everyone. So Carey's response was, no ma'am, I was just a cobbler. In other words, he didn't make shoes, he just repaired them. How can you embarrass a man like that? She tries to shame him. He makes an even more self-deprecating, humble statement. That's another way to beat your opponents and your critics. When people tell you how bad you are, tell them, actually, God knows I'm far worse than that. Who can argue with that? Carey fought against the idea that a woman's life ceases to be valuable after her husband's death. He undermined the oppression and the exploitation of women by providing women with education. He empowered women with literacy, knowledge, skills. In fact, the Indians soon complained that the Christian women were better educated than their philosophers. He opened the first schools for girls in all of India. Education was a major emphasis of his mission. In 1800, Carey was invited to lecture on Bengali, Sanskrit, and Marathi at Fort William College, providing him with essential income that not only sustained his family, but funded his printing presses, his Bible translations, his school establishments. This was a wonderful blessing. And this is just 7 years after he had arrived in India, the British government is begging him to teach them Bengali, Sanskrit, and Marathi. Nobody else knew these languages as well as him. This is a man who had the gift of tongues in a real way. 35 languages. How does anyone master so many languages? Enough to translate the Bible into it. In 1806, he was made a professor. Not bad for a cobbler who didn't have high school. In 1818, he and his colleagues launched Serampore College, which taught theology, botany, zoology, Sanskrit, Arabic, and English literature. And then much more later. See the symbol of it. The St. George's Cross, the Holy Bible, and the bird, the bird who takes her own blood to feed her young, because there's no other food available. Feeds her children from her own blood, a symbol of Christ. And so, King Frederick of Denmark granted the charter for Serampore College. It was Carey's relentless battle against Sooty for 25 years, which finally led to the famous edict in 1829 banning widow burning, called Carey's Edict. Carey had a comprehensive view of the Great Commission. He understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He ministered to body. He ministered to soul. He ministered to mind, to spirit. He founded the Agricultural Horticultural Society in the 1820s. This was 30 years before the Royal Agricultural Society was established in England. He was not just a trendsetter in India and Asia. He's a trendsetter even by the standards of England. He introduced the steam engine to India. He pioneered the idea of lending libraries, because books are knowledge and books empower people to enable the poor people to have access to books that they could never buy. He persuaded friends in England to ship out tons of books to regenerate and reform India. And by the way, when I read that in reading on William Carey, it sparked the idea for Literature of Africa. And I started writing to my friends overseas who are authors, and James Kindy was the first to send us 1,000 books as an author, and David Noble sent us more, and before we knew it, we were getting from R.J. Rushdoony and Gary DeMar and wonderful, blessed books from tremendous authors. And so this is where it all began, us asking, do any of you have books that you can share, Bibles? And now it's been taken up by Eagle's Nest Ministries, Edwin Hodges Ministries and others, who's sending us containers. In this last year, we received 194 tons of Bibles and books and Sunday school materials that we received free from overseas, which we're distributing free. We've distributed over 160 tons in this last year, of which 60 tons went to Zimbabwe. So that idea came from reading about the example of Carey. Carey wrote to his friends back in England and said, send us books. And that idea was, wow, that's a great way that our friends could help support us in our work in Africa. People want Bibles and books. Let's ask if our friends overseas can send. Now at the time, I was thinking of boxes and mail sacks. I was not thinking containers. We wouldn't have had the kind of driveway we've got at our mission. But nevertheless, praise God that we are getting tons of books. And it all came from an example from 200 years ago from William Carey. William Carey also introduced the study of astronomy into India. He saw that the prevalent astrology, with its fatalism, its superstitious fears, its inability to manage time, had terribly destructive consequences. Hinduism's astrology makes us subjects, where lives are determined by the stars. Like people turning to the astrology papers, what do my stars say? Just because I was born between these dates, I'm going to be with that 1/12 of the world's population is going to have this happen to me today. I mean, really. Does that make sense to anybody? Blind fate determined by the stars. However, the Christian science of astronomy sets us free to be rulers, not subjects, because we can devise calendars on the basis of the stars and the planets. We can identify directions. We can study geography. We can better plan to live and work. Carey was the first man in India to write essays on forestry. 50 years before the government made its first attempt at forestry conservation, the missionary, William Carey, was already practicing conservation, planting and cultivating timber. Why? He needs paper for all the printing of the Bibles and books. That's going to take away trees in the forest. He wants to plant more trees than has to be cut down. He wants to improve the earth because of the dominion mandate. He understands the dominion mandate. God has made man responsible for the earth. William Carey is also a botanist. In fact, this is an interesting point because he was always fascinated with nature and he wanted to be a gardener. When he was a young boy, he wanted to be a gardener. And he was told that his skin was so fair, he was too in danger of sunburn. So he was told that he could not be a gardener in England. And so he ended up as a missionary in India, where the sun is a whole lot hotter, as you might have guessed. Just shows you, make a plan, not an excuse. Why take somebody's prescription for you who says, oh, you can only do this? Teddy Roosevelt, my personal favorite American president, was told that he couldn't climb stairs, so instead he went out and climbed mountains. He was so unhealthy, they told him he couldn't live in a house that had an upper and lower story. He literally climbed mountains and walked across the continent and did feats that no one else would imagine, because he would not become a victim. He would not become in bondage to the predictions of some unsaved doctors. I mean, why would he let them determine the parameters of his life? I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Well, William Carey was a botanist who cultivated beautiful gardens like the Serampore Gardens and Calcutta Botanical Gardens. He frequently lectured on science, botany, and zoology. Because he believed all thy works praise thee, O Lord, he knew nature is worthy of study. William Carey pointed out that even insects are worthy of attention. Does not the Bible say, look to the ant? Learn from the ant. There's a lot you can learn from the organization, the diligence, the work ethic of the ant. Insects have a lot to teach us. They're not souls in bondage, but creatures with a God-given purpose. William Carey was the father of print technology in India. He introduced the modern science of printing. He built what was then the largest printing press in India, and he devised the fonts. Of course, they didn't have any Hindu fonts because nobody had been producing printed works of theirs before. But in 1812, a devastating fire destroyed William Carey's warehouse with his printing presses, his paper stock, his manuscripts representing years of work. He had one long, big warehouse building that included the offices, the storage place, the printing press, and it was all burned out. In fact, it's also an example in survival, or what not to do, because not only was everything under one roof, but he was actually not even there. He was lecturing at Fort William College when the fire broke out, and the fire was put out before much damage was done. But then some helpful Indian walked around opening all the windows to clear the smoke out. And you know what makes a fire? Fuel, heat, and oxygen. That's the fire triangle. You collapse a fire by getting rid of the fuel, lowering the heat, like with water or powder, or depriving it of oxygen. By opening all the windows, oxygen flooding, and the fire that was in recess sprang into life, exploded, and destroyed the entire warehouse, and nothing was saved. Even in the face of this catastrophe, Carey praised God that no lives had been lost, and he quoted Psalm 46, "Be still and know that I am God." He resolved to do better translations than the ones that were now ashes. He said, "Every branch that bears fruit he purges, that it might bring forth more fruit. The Lord has laid me low, that I might look more simply to him, however vexing it may be. A road the second time traveled is usually taken with more confidence and more ease than the first." William Carey quoted Isaiah 61 and trusted God for better printing presses, more accurate translations, a phoenix rising out of the ashes. Not only was Carey hit by fire, but deaths in each of the seven missionary families at Serampore that year. Carey himself had just buried a grandson. Carey had to endure unjust, unbalanced criticisms from young new missionaries who actually split from the Serampore mission, and slanderous accusations of the mission side in England, as well as an earthquake and a flood. You see, William Carey went out the field, and he was in the field for 42 years. He never went back home. He's buried in India. And so the whole generation of Mission Society board back at home died out. And a new board arose who had never even met William Carey and didn't understand his eccentric way of operating. And some of the young missionaries who went out didn't understand either. Instead of learning and asking questions, finding out why they did things in some of the apparently strange ways that Carey, Marshman, and Ward did, they assumed that they were wrong, split from it, wrote letters back complaining to the mission, and William Carey was kicked out of the mission he had actually started. Yet despite the controversies, the calamities, and the conflicts, William Carey's monumental achievements outshine all his critics. I mean, what have they ever accomplished? He was a dedicated Christian whom God used in extraordinary ways to launch the greatest century of missionary advance. India, a Hindu country, produced this 6-rupee stamp of William Carey, 1993, on the 200th anniversary of the arrival of William Carey, and honoring his translation work and his education work of Serampore College in the stamp. I don't know if England ever printed a postage stamp to William Carey, but India did. He translated the scripts into more languages than any other translator in history. And he saved literally millions of lives by his compassionate social action and tireless labors. And the Department of Post in India honored him with this first day edition. He excelled as a missionary strategist. He was humble. He was hardworking. He was industrious and he was persistent. He knew about spiritual stamina. If you talk about spiritual stamina, William Carey definitely is one exhibit A up there. He persevered for over 41 years without any furlough in the field. We need to follow his example by ministering to body, mind, and spirit, and persevering through all disappointments and opposition with an unshakable faith in God's sovereign power. And so you can see Carey Baptist Church, founded in 1809. This tablet was set up on the 200th anniversary of the opening of this church. And here's some of the people at Serampore College, one of the graduating classes. Serampore College today, and Serampore College continues to be an effective institution. And there's many other colleges named after William Carey to this day. The second example of these two that I want to give tonight is Dr. David Livingstone. Here is an example of excellence. His life, his legacy, and his literature continue to speak to us today. And the challenge of David Livingstone is most relevant to our times. If you want to know why Frontline Fellowship's mission headquarters is named Livingstone House, this is why. If Dr. David Livingstone was here today, if we could have him arrive and give a presentation here at this Great Commission course, what do you think he would say to us? That's quite a thought. But we do not need to guess. We have his writings, we have his published statements available. We can know exactly what David Livingstone would say to us today. It's what he said to the people of his own time. The salvation of men ought to be the chief design aim of every Christian. All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard the word of God like a miser. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the trader? If you have men who will only come if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. We must be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy, devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We still have a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there's no greater privilege on earth than after having our own chains broken off to go forth and proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of prison to them that are bound. Dr. David Livingstone was inspired by an optimistic view of the future. Like most of the missionaries of the 19th century, Livingstone held to the eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are culminative, he said, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and bow before him. Our work and its fruit are culminative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchman of the night, who worked when all was gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions shared our path. They will doubtless have more light than we, but we serve our master earnestly, and we proclaim the same gospel that they will do. He wrote in his journal of a quiet audience today, "The seed is being sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is as if it were a small stone cut out of the mountain, but it will fill the whole earth." He takes visions from Daniel. We work for a glorious future, which we are not destined to see. The golden age, which has not yet been, but yet will be. We are only morning stars shining in the dark. But the glorious morn will break. The good time is coming yet. The dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth. For this time, we work. By different agencies, the great ruler is bringing all things into a focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself, and he is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. Today, there are over 500 million Christians in Africa who claim to be Christians. When David Livingstone began his work, there were not even 5 million Christians in all of Africa. Today, there are 500 million. This includes 150 million Protestants, 50 million Anglicans, 140 million Charismatics, 60 million Pentecostals, and 100 million Independents. Now, we're not suggesting they're all born again and have a right relationship with the Lord, but that is a phenomenal fruit. David Livingstone plowed the stony ground. He sowed the gospel seed that has produced this great harvest, which includes many who are sincere, dedicated believers. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. These are verses that David Livingstone frequently quoted in his correspondence and in his books. I must say that the life and the legacy of David Livingstone changed my life. As a new Christian, converted in 1977, I imbibed many of the presuppositions and tendencies of churches in the 1970s. I read The Late Great Planet Earth, and There's a New World Coming, and Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth. Another date-setting, end-times, rapture fever publications. I watched Like a Thief in the Night and The Distant Thunder and all those other films. And I was saved. I loved the Lord. I was enthusiastically involved in evangelism. But my understanding of biblical doctrine was actually quite shallow. I imbibed the prevailing prejudice against Calvinism. I was convinced that we were living in the last days. I remember saying some pretty horrible things about Calvinism. In ignorance, because that's what others said, and I just assumed that was the clever spiritual thing to say, before I'd read one single thing about what John Calvin really believed and did. But because I was convinced we were living in the last days, I could not at that time consider marriage or children. There wasn't enough time. I mean, the Lord's coming back before the end of 1977, 78, 79, certainly before the end of 80. Look, the planets are lining up in 1982. We're going to have earthquakes, tremors, everything. There's going to be, no doubt, all of Matthew 24 fulfilled. So I was betting people Lord would come before 1982 and so on. I could not allow myself to be distracted by worldly matters like family and raising children. I need to devote the last few days on earth to snatching souls from the fire. I was an end times rapture fever fanatic. The rapture was coming surely before the end that year. I was closed to ideas of theological training. There's no way I could go to theological college. What's the point of going and studying for years when the Lord's going to come back in a matter of months? Can you use my time better? I must stay in the field, snatching souls in these last few remaining hours. Then I read The Puritan Hope, Revival and the Interpretation of Prophecy by Ian Murray, published by Banner of Truth. This book informed me that all of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement were Calvinist and post-millennialist. Now, I had no idea what post-millennialism was, but when I read that the father of modern missions, William Carey, and the best friend Africa ever had, David Livingstone, that they were both reformed and post-millennial, I determined to read up more on these matters. I mean, I had to. Now, earlier I'd read a thin, sanitized modern biography on David Livingstone, but it didn't seem too extraordinary, because like most modern books, it had been sanitized. All controversial or politically incorrect details had been omitted. The modern censored version of Livingstone's life that I first read did not mention the ravages of the Islamic slave trade, which Livingstone confronted, documented, and fought against. It left out his Calvinist convictions, his post-millennial eschatology of victory. And the modern biographies leave out the fact that David Livingstone carried a six-barreled revolver and a double-barreled rifle, which was very advanced for the 1840s. His violent confrontations with Islamic slave traders and bold initiatives to set thousands of captives free, burning hundreds of yokes of slaves at Nkotokoto Bay and Lake Malawi and the Zambezi province on. Those had all been censored out of these modern biographies. Too controversial to include in modern abridged versions of Livingstone's life. Now, I've always been something of a bookworm, and I have a love for books and history. So finding most of the books available in the average bookstore to be quite shallow and predictable, it's like they've got a certain mantra that they repeat and there's just a few variations, you're not allowed to go out of those parameters. I developed a preference for scouring through second-hand bookshops and finding rare old first editions of these missionaries and pioneers. I was reading much of Livingstone's missionary travels as I was following in his footsteps in Tete province in Mozambique and Zambezi Valley in 1989. That was when I and the medical team I was leading were captured by Russian forces and interrogated in SNASP security prison Mashava, Maputo. What I learned from the writings and from the exemplary life and extraordinary legacy of David Livingstone transformed my life and ministry completely. So what did I learn from David Livingstone? I learned from David Livingstone the importance of discipline. He was disciplined in reading. He was disciplined in exercise. He was self-controlled. Livingstone abstained from alcohol for life. He was temperate. He was duty-oriented. He was hard-working. Livingstone's work ethic is a rebuke to us all. See what you think. From age 10, Livingstone worked 14 hours a day. 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, walking an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling, stooping position, amongst, under, or over machinery, bounced over it, because he was working in a cotton mill. Imagine the tremendous physical training. This was for his later transcontinental expeditions throughout Africa. But all this he did in esteemed heat and humidity, considered essential for the production of thread. David used his first week's wages to purchase a book on Latin. Now remember, he's age 10. Now I remember what I spent my first month's wages on. When I left school, I was 17 years old. Got my first job at Old Mutual. And after a month, I got my paycheck. And what did I spend my money on? I bought a briefcase, a black umbrella, and a suit. By the way, the suit cost 20 rand. It was a good suit. Wonderful that we're so free now and that things have improved so much. But David Livingstone, at age 10, bought a book on Latin. Which of us would buy a book on Latin at age 10? Now, less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read or write. Not even 10%. David not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Every night after work, he had attended night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Some people think we are extreme to have lectures in the evening at a camp. Well, David Livingstone worked from 6 in the morning till 8 in the evening, and then he went to night school from 8 to 10. Then at home, he would study off until midnight. Each morning began at 5:30 a.m. and his work day at 6 a.m. And by the way, there were no holidays aside from religious holidays and Sunday. That was it. 6 day week, 14-hour day. When he was studying medicine and theology, and by the way, I've read people saying that he earned a bursary. There were no bursaries in the 1830s. Are they out of their mind? No. He saved up every penny, put himself through medical school and theological school, and he walked there. When he was studying medicine and theology, he would walk from Blantyre to Glasgow, refusing every offer of a ride on a horse cart passing by. He preferred the 4-hour walk, often in the snow, which would be Monday mornings to Glasgow and Friday evenings back from Glasgow, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career in missions. Livingstone never expected charity. Although being brought up in the poorest of circumstances, where a family of 7 were forced to live in a single room, this room, 10 feet by 14 feet, without any electricity, plumbing or running water. That was their home. Parents' bed, the rest of them were sleeping on the floor, and a few mattresses tucked in under the bed that were pulled out at night. He worked and saved up to put himself through both medical school and theological college. David Livingstone was the first worker from the cotton mills to receive a university education, and nobody gave it to him. He didn't accept charity from anyone. He earned it, and he passed it with the highest honors, and he received his doctorate from the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons in November 1840. He was ordained as a congregational minister 20 November 1840. Against all odds, he achieved far more than anyone would have thought humanly possible for someone born into such a poverty-stricken, disadvantaged background. His family had one of the flats in his tenement for cotton workers. He did not wait for someone else to open up Africa, to invent four-wheel drive vehicles, to build the roads and the bridges. He drew the first maps of the Zambezi River. He did not have an attitude of entitlement. David Livingstone had a Protestant work ethic. To achieve what he did, Livingstone was decisive, he was goal-oriented, and he was inflexible. Reformed theology put doctrinal steel in his backbone. He was a man of integrity, a man of his word. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. He walked many thousands of miles across difficult and dangerous terrain to return his porters to their village. When he finished his first missionary journey, his first objective, which was to get to Luanda, he walked through South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Angola, and got to the port of Luanda. And there was the ship, the Forerunner, ready to take him home. But he didn't want to risk his porters being captured by slave raiders on the way back. He escorted them to protect them all the way back to their village, adding another 2 years to his mission, which had almost killed him on the way over. He could have been with his family in a few weeks, and he chose another 2 years because he's a man of honor. David Livingstone understood the power of prayer. He had Holy Spirit fire in his heart, soul and mind, and he prayed and sang the Psalms daily. He had a great love for God's creation, for nature and for wildlife. His books are filled with intricate sketches and fascinating details on animals and wildlife and vegetation, much of which he is the first person to alert us to the existence of some of these creatures. David Livingstone was inspired by post-millennial eschatology of victory. He had a kingdom vision. David Livingstone understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He worked to comprehensively fulfill the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. As a doctor, a medical doctor, he ministered to the body. As a teacher, he ministered to the mind. And as a preacher of the gospel, he ministered to the spirit. Wherever he went, he used his medical knowledge and training, his breadth of reading and learning, and his deep faith and knowledge of the Holy Scriptures to enrich and empower the people of Africa. David Livingstone teaches us that actions speak louder than words. He was described as a man of resolute courage. You know, some years ago, some publication, The New African, did a reader survey, who's the greatest African of all time? And their readers came out with Robert Mugabe. I thought, well, that's got to be ridiculous. What kind of readers do they have? So I did a reader survey of our Christian Action magazine. Okay, they subscribe to Christian Action, but still, we did a reader survey, and this is people in about 14, 15 countries in Africa, as far as Nigeria, Congo, Sudan, so on, Egypt. Far and away, no close second, David Livingstone was voted the greatest African of all time. I find there's no other name in all of Africa more respected than that of David Livingstone. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop Livingstone the fulfillment of any recognized duty. Indeed, he would not let swamps stop him. Rivers didn't stop him. Deserts and mountains did not prevent him from opening up Africa for the gospel. David Livingstone was determined to make a difference. The Great Commission was his supreme ambition. Christ's last command was his first concern. He wrote, I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things and plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. I am a missionary heart and soul. God had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation of him I am or ever wish to be. In his service, I hope to live. In it, I wish to die. I shall open up a path to the interior, or I will die trying. May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we are to be outdone by slave traders. Battling rains, chronic discomfort, rust, mildew and rot, totally drenched and fatigued, laid low by fever countless times. Livingstone continued to persevere across the continent. This is an example of spiritual stamina. 60 times he suffered malaria. Did not stop him, keeping on, keeping on. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. Often Livingstone endured excessive and unnecessary suffering. and deprivation, hacking his way through dense jungle on foot because lack of funds prevented him the luxury of affording a canoe. I would not have thought a canoe a luxury when you're mapping the Zambezi River. These privations, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices, he wrote. I think that word ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything we can do for him, who, though he was rich, yet for our sakes, he became poor. The challenge of Livingston rings out to us today. In fact, we've got it up on our mission banner here. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. David Livingston emphasized that sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We need to put feet to our faith. You notice the boots on our banners. Livingston also alerted the world to the cancerous sore of the Islamic slave trade. It was this missionary explorer, David Livingston, whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light, including this is one of the sketches he put in one of his books. David Livingston taught that you cannot be neutral in the battlefields of life. He had the courage to confront evil. His fearless faith fought the good fight of faith and set many thousands of captives free. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. David Livingston is an example of extraordinary patience and perseverance. He overcame every obstacle. He walked across the continent of Africa. He walked from Delgoa Bay, present-day Port Elizabeth, all the way through Kraaifontein up to Kuruman, in what is today the Northern Cape. He walked across what is today Botswana, all the way back across the Cape Colony to Cape Town, to place his family on a ship to return to Britain. He walked from Cape Town across the whole of the Cape Province, across Botswana, Zambia, Angola, to the port of Luanda. He walked from the Atlantic Ocean in the west, all the way across the continent of Africa, crossing what is today Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique to the Indian Ocean. And he measured and mapped out this cross-section of the continent, which is in his book. I've got it in the original first edition. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Even though he was sick with fever a lot of the time, he never failed to have his thermometer in the water as he was boiling his water for tea to see at what temperature it boiled and to work out what the altitude was. He never failed at night to use the sextant to work out from the stars what his longitude and latitudes were. His maps, when you compare his maps of the Zambezi and the hinterland of Africa with our satellite maps, he's on target. He's right. He mapped out Victoria Falls 1,860 yards across. That's what it is. He crawled to the edge and dropped down a weighted rope, counted out, measured it, 310 feet high. That's what it is. Without GPS and all the rest, this man managed to get it right. He came back and he explored much of the Zambezi River, the Shiri Valley, the Rovuma River, walking across what is today Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. Yet in all these things we are more than conquerors through Christ Jesus, who loved us. On his third great missionary journey, he walked across the whole length of Tanzania, much of Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia, Congo, Burundi, and he finally died on his knees in the province of Luapula in northern Zambia. In his 30 years of dedicated missionary service in Africa, he walked from coast to coast across what are today 12 vast countries. He walked across a continent that did not yet have roads, bridges, or purified water. I shall hold myself in readiness to go anywhere provided be forwards, he said. David Livingston teaches us the power of the printed page. It was the books that he read, like Practical Christianity by William Wilberforce, which channeled much of his life in dedicated labors to eradicate the slave trade and open up Africa to the gospel. David Livingston wrote Missionary Travels, the Zambezi Expedition, and his journals, which inspired generations of missionaries to dedicate their lives to winning Africa for Christ. Livingston's example inspired Mary Slessor, for example, to devote her life to Calabar, present-day Nigeria, and Peter Cameron to launch the Africa Inland Mission, one of the largest missions in Africa today. Peter Cameron had returned from Africa in failure after his first mission. However, when he read the inscription on the tomb of David Livingstone in Westminster Abbey, "Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice." Cameron was rebuked, inspired, and resolved to return to Africa. By the way, I don't know if you've noticed, but this is right dead center as you enter Westminster Abbey. If you watched William and Catherine's wedding, the wedding of the decade, as they walked in, there were flower pots all the way around Livingstone's tomb, and they had to walk around the red carpet, went around it. That's, if you go back to your video, if you've got it, everyone has to, he gets the premier spot in Westminster Abbey. They don't put the red carpet ever over Livingstone's tomb. They've got to go around, but it's dead center. Livingstone knew the power of the printed page and of public speaking tours. He focused on universities as strategic for mobilizing reformers and missionaries to fulfill the Great Commission. Livingstone saw rivers not as obstacles, but as God's highway to reach Africa for Christ. All communities need access to water. Rivers are strategic arteries which missionaries can utilize to fulfill the Great Commission. Livingstone believed in leadership training. His vision was to establish a Bible college for Africans to be trained as evangelists, teachers, missionaries to disciple the nations. His mission society would not accept that vision. The life and legacy of David Livingstone has taught me the importance of discipline, exercise, reading, a Christian work ethic, temperance, self-control, self-denial, and to be duty-oriented. His reformed theology has put doctrinal steel in my backbone. He has taught me the importance of being a man of my word, a person of integrity, and most important, a student of God's word. The post-millennial eschatology of victory of David Livingstone has inspired me that we are not working at uncertainty. The Lord who gave us the Great Commission will enable us to fulfill that Great Commission. His promises and his power are fully sufficient to empower the church to fulfill his Great Commission, making disciples of all nations, teaching obedience to all things that he has commanded. David Livingstone's comprehensive vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, has raised the standards of missionary service for all of us. It is a rebuke to religious tourism. Actions speak louder than words. Sacrificial service is more eloquent than many sermons. We must put feet to our faith. We must recognize we're in a world war of worldviews. Now, this picture is an interesting picture. Kuruman is not too far from Kimberley. And David Livingstone, being a student, botanist, scientist of note, he knew exactly what he was seeing there. He picked up diamonds, big diamonds, and he threw them into the bush and never said a word about them. Now, the only reason we know about this is because when Henry Morton Stanley met with David Livingstone in 1871, of course David Livingstone wanted to know what's the news of the outside world. And Henry Morton Stanley said, well, Prussia's defeated Denmark and France and Austria, which was a big surprise because those were the superpowers at that time. And German Empire's been established in Palace of Versailles after defeating Napoleon III. And the Suez Canal has now made it possible to sail directly through Mediterranean to Asia, and all sorts of extraordinary things. And one of the things he mentioned was, and they've discovered diamonds in Kimberley. And at that point, Livingstone shook his head, nodded his head and said, I know. I knew they would discover it there in time, I just didn't know when. And he explained that he saw the diamonds, threw them away, didn't even mention it to his wife. So of course the question of Henry Morton Stanley is, why didn't you just sell some of the diamonds? He said, well, people knew where I worked and they would have gone and found. And he said, we were still in the earlier stages of evangelizing and discipling the Tswana people. If the diamond miners had rushed in there with all the bottle stores and everything else, it would have wrecked the people before we could give them scriptural foundations for the future. We didn't need materialism there before they even had spiritual rebirth. How's that for self-discipline? How's that for focus? How's that for keeping the main thing the main thing? Islam is a threat to faith and freedom. You cannot be neutral, confront evil, Fight the good fight of faith. Be bold, be brave, be courageous. Be patient and steadfast. Persevere. Overcome every obstacle. Go forward in the faith. Never forget the power of the Prince of Page. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. Read. Teach your people to love reading. Readers make leaders. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. Do not forget the schools and the colleges and the universities. They are strategic. We must disciple the next generation to be faithful to God's word and effective in God's service. Think strategically about how we can reach the nations for Christ. Make your life count for eternity. In the words of C.T. Studd, another great missionary who'd be worthy of another study, you only have one life. It'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last. As William Carey declared, expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. So, what did David Livingstone say to us today? I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know that in a few short years, I shall be cut off from that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. Will you carry out the work which I have begun? I leave it with you. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And then I said, here am I, Lord, send me. Any questions, any comments? William Carey, David Livingstone. Yes.
I have a question about David Livingstone. I know some personal, very close Christians that would say that the Christian minister's duty would be first to protect his family and to raise up a good family, or at least not to neglect the family. Throughout his life, David Livingstone, once he sent his wife and children back to Europe, appeared to neglect them. Is that a good example of
Christian? David Livingstone is not the person we would lift out as the example of focus on the family, no. But let's be fair. They did not have the communications and transport systems open to us in our generation. It was expected of men of Britain in that day to be away from their family for years. Merchant marine, Royal Navy, colonial service, where they work in India or whatever, you couldn't take your families with. It was expected of missionaries until not that long ago to send their children to boarding schools while the parents were in dangerous areas and climates. It was not considered neglectful then. Today we've got people saying you must phone your wife every single day that you're away, and of course we've got the technology that you could actually do that most of the time. You can also be back from the field fairly often if you can't take your family with you. I used to undertake missions of 4.5 months before I was married. When I got married, the longest I've been away from my family is 9 or 10 weeks. And my wife was brought up in a missionary family. Her father's away a lot. She grew up in Europe in Salzburg with her father going behind the Iron Curtain. My wife doesn't think it's very unusual me having to be away for this time. Well, people like Mary Moffat, David Livingstone married a Moffat. Robert Moffat, his father-in-law, was a tough missionary who spent 50 years in the field establishing one of the premier mission stations in Africa. Pioneer of Prince Evangelism, so on in Africa. And Robert Moffat was severely criticized by his parents-in-law for taking their daughter, Mary, to Africa, just as Mary Moffat, senior, condemned David Livingstone, his son-in-law, for taking her daughter into more remote parts of Africa. But to be honest, she is complaining about what her own mother had complained about with her. To be fair, David Livingstone could not have done the work that he did without being absent from his family for long times. He certainly provided for them. His book sales meant his family was comfortable. They did not lack, but they lacked for a father, obviously. His oldest son went and fought in the American War between the states. He's buried in America. That's Robert Livingstone. So it's tragic that he was separated from his family. But again, to be fair, when David Livingstone first started his missionary journeys, he took his wife and children with him. When they all got sick and one of their newborn daughters died, Elizabeth died in the field, He was criticized by everyone, including his parents in law, for the irresponsibility of taking his wife and children with him into the field. When he left them behind and went on his own, he was criticized for leaving them behind. In his second missionary journey, he brought his wife with him, Mary Moffat, and she died in the field in what today is Mozambique and Zambezi Valley. We've been to her grave, and tragic, she's just in her 30s, 36 I think. And he was criticized for taking his wife with him. So to be fair, we're talking about the 1840s, 1850s here. Transportation took ages. It took him 4 months just to get from England to South Africa and up to Kuruma. So he didn't have what we have today. We can't judge him by our standards of technology and transportation. It was not just him. Many other missionaries. You take the first Protestant missionary to China, Robert Morrissey. He was separated from his wife for 6 years at one occasion. 6 years. It's even longer than Livingstone was separated from his wife. Longest year separated from her was 4 years. So I think it's unfair to criticize David Livingstone as though what he did was exceptional. A lot of men in the Army, Navy, Merchant Marine, and missions were separate from families for as long a period. So it wasn't exceptional, but when we look at it, it certainly was not ideal. And we have better options available today. So let's not be anachronistically unfair of blaming people of another era by our standards of today. Let's judge him according to Fez that time. He was not considered by the people of that time as neglectful to his family, not generally. He is considered as an example of a man who put duty and the kingdom of God first, and that was considered the way to go. And you got the impression that his wife and children thought that that's what he should do, and that it was a privilege to have their father making such sacrifices, and for them to have the privilege to also make sacrifices for the kingdom. That was the mindset of that time. I can't imagine James Dobson being too thrilled about that though. I've given an abbreviated on both William Carey and David Livingstone for this presentation. In my full presentation, David Livingstone, I would be pointing out that he is the one who identified, in fact, he put the tsetse fly on the fly leaf of his book. He said the biggest enemy to missions in Africa is the tsetse fly, and the second one is a mosquito. And he's quite right. He said, forget the lion and the rhino, it's the tsetse fly and the mosquito. He is the one who first identified the mosquito as the cause of malaria. At that time, medical science was convinced that malaria is caused by bad air. Think of the name, malaria. Malaria, bad air. The very etymology of the word shows that the scientists of the time believed malaria is caused by bad air. Solution, high ceilings. Let the bad air go up to the ceiling. And David Livingstone said, no, mosquitoes cause it. In fact, pregnant mosquitoes cause it. And they lay the eggs in you between 11 o'clock at night and about 5, 6 in the morning. If you're under your mosquito net between about 11 at night and 5 or 6 in the morning, you won't get malaria. You might get bitten by mosquitoes, but you won't get malaria. Well, he's right. He's that observant, a person. And he tested on himself all sorts of things, and he finally found out that quinine was the perfect solution. He picked up quinine in Brazil as he's coming to South Africa, and their ship was drawn, of course, lost their main mast, had to put in at Rio de Janeiro for repairs, and he wandered through the mountains between evangelizing at the waterfront there, and he took different samples of bushes, and being the inquiring man he was, he had the quinine bush, which is from Brazil, and he took some of that, and that was one of the things he tried to treat his malaria with, and he discovered quinine as a solution to malaria. It took 30 years for medical science to catch up with Livingstone and realize he was right, not only about the cause of malaria, but the cure. And he attributes the quinine to how he stayed alive through 60 bouts of malaria, which killed many people first time. So Livingstone was a phenomenal scientist, and is what he did to counter disease in Africa and save lives was incredible. He was a scientist of top note. He was a geographer of top note. He was a missionary, an educator, and a doctor of high standard. So this is an example of excellence. We Christians do not need to be backward and guilt manipulated, as though somehow Christians are intellectually inferior or anything like that. We've got the best in our history and heritage, and we should again be aiming to produce the best science, the best art, the best literature, the best music, the best films. Why not? That's our heritage. So, good. Any other comments or questions?